They called them suicides, coincidences, cold cases. But they weren't. Carmen Delgado, Evan Hart, Isla Moran, all gone. All erased. My name is Jade Whitlock. I was just a reporter until I found the folder that changed everything. What I uncovered? Offshore accounts, fake charities, red tape wrapped around murder. This isn't fiction. These are true crime stories buried under financial corruption and bureaucracy, shadows of justice they hoped you'd never see. But we're digging now, and they can't erase us all. Welcome to the story they tried to silence. Oh, by the way, if you haven't already, we invite you to follow us on your favorite platform so you never miss a story. The file no one was meant to find. I never considered myself brave. Not really. Not in the way that earns medals or headlines. I was just a girl with a journalism degree, student loan debt, and a habit of asking too many questions. I didn't wear a badge, didn't carry a gun, didn't know how to navigate the dangerous side of truth. But what I lacked in courage, I made up for in obsession. And sometimes, obsession can be just as dangerous. It was a Tuesday. Rain tapped lazily against the windows of the Municipal Records Building in Boston, the kind of day where everything felt too quiet, too dim, like the city had exhaled and forgotten to breathe back in. I was on a routine research assignment for a feature story, something forgettable about housing permits and expired contracts, a favor for a senior editor who had more power than interest in details. That's when I saw it. A slim, misfiled folder tucked between zoning cases from 2009. It didn't belong there. Its label was crooked. The ink faded like it had been typed years ago and stuffed away in a hurry. I should have ignored it. God knows I had deadlines to hit and an editor breathing down my neck. But there was something about it, the kind of something that pulls you, like a whisper through a locked door. I opened it. The first line hit like a slap. Case closed. Apparent suicide. No further investigation required. But it wasn't the conclusion that got me. It was the contradiction. The deceased was a woman named Carmen Delgado, 27, marketing executive, found dead in her apartment, locked from the inside. The official cause of death was listed as self-inflicted overdose. But the notes, they told another story. There were bruises, unexplained abrasions, a smashed lamp that didn't match the story. And worse, her last cell phone call had been to 911. The transcript was garbled, fragmented, but clear enough. They're here. They know I know. They'll kill me. I froze. This wasn't a suicide. This was a panic, a confession, a final cry for help that no one heard. Or worse, no one wanted to hear. I should have returned the file. I should have told someone, but I couldn't. Something in me had already changed. I spent the next 3 nights digging. I barely slept. Carmen's name wasn't on any major databases. No obituary. No media coverage. No family statements. She had disappeared into silence. Until I checked her employment records. That's when things got dark. Carmen had been working for a boutique financial consulting firm, Sable and Dorn. Sounded upscale. Harmless. Except, it no longer existed. Dissolved just 2 weeks after her death. Their website? Wiped. Social media? Gone. And the co-founders? Now operating under different LLCs in 3 different states. I started mapping connections. It was slow. I wasn't a hacker or a forensic accountant. Just a stubborn girl with too much coffee and access to LexisNexis. And then I found it. A wire transfer, $200, 00, from an offshore account registered in the British Virgin Islands, routed to a shell company in Carmen's name, a week before she died. There it was, the motive, the crime, the reason she had to disappear. And somehow, no one cared. I tried to bring it to my editor. He listened politely, scrolled through my notes, and then sighed like I was a child telling ghost stories. Jade, I get it. You're hungry. But this isn't news. It's ancient history. Dead girl. No suspects. No audience. I left his office feeling small, furious, and more sure than ever. This wasn't a cold case. This was a cover-up, and I was going to blow it wide open. I started recording. Nothing fancy. Just voice memos. Stitched together in my bedroom closet with a mic I bought off Craigslist. I called it Justice Tales. It felt right. Like the kind of bedtime story no one wants to hear, but needs to. The episode aired on a Wednesday. 47 people listened, One of them changed my life. Her name was Leona. She sent me a DM at 2:13 a.m. I know Carmen's case. My sister, same story. We need to talk. We met at a cafe outside Worcester. Leona looked exhausted. Thin, pale, but sharp. The kind of sharp that's carved by grief. Her sister's name was Taylor Mendez. Died in 2015. Also ruled a suicide. Also had money transferred under her name. Also worked for a financial firm that disappeared after her death. Leona had the paperwork, copies of emails, financial statements, a resignation letter that was never sent. She said she found something she shouldn't have, that she didn't feel safe. Then she was gone. I begged the cops to look into it, and they told me it was grief, that I was seeing ghosts. She looked at me then, eyes rimmed red. But I know what I saw, and you just proved I'm not crazy. I couldn't breathe. Two women, two fake suicides, two sinister cases, buried by bureaucracy and silence. This wasn't a coincidence. This was a pattern. That night, I couldn't sleep. I stared at my wall, now covered in notes, pins, and scribbled theories. Carmen, Taylor, transfers, shell companies, fake firms, vanishing LLCs, all hidden under layers of red tape. I felt a shift, like I had passed a point of no return. No more background work. No more whispering into the void. If no one else was going to peel back the curtain, then I would. One voice. One case. One tape at a time. I hit record. This is Jade Whitlock. Welcome to Justice Tales. And tonight, I'm telling you about the women they tried to erase. But just as I prepared the second episode, my email pinged. A message from an encrypted account. You're getting too close. Stop digging. And attached to it, a photo of me, walking home from the cafe. Someone was watching. Buried in bureaucracy, I stared at the photo for a long time. It was grainy, probably taken from a cheap camera phone, but there was no mistaking it. My coat, my scarf, my coffee cup. I was walking alone. There was no timestamp, no caption, just the image and the threat behind it. You're getting too close. Stop digging. Most people would have stopped. Should've. But for me, it only confirmed what I'd already suspected. Carmen and Taylor hadn't died by accident. They were erased, covered up. And now, I had a target on my back for daring to care. Still, that night, I double-locked every door in my apartment, slept with a flashlight clutched in one hand and a kitchen knife under my pillow. Courage wasn't what kept me going. It was fear. And the twisted, undeniable truth that these stories deserved to be told. I wasn't just chasing ghosts anymore. I was chasing people who didn't want to be found. I kept a low profile the next day, told my editor I had a migraine, turned off my phone, and packed a backpack with my notes, my laptop, and every piece of evidence I had gathered so far. I took a bus across town to a public library, old, quiet, with dusty computers, and nobody looking twice at a girl with headphones and a determined expression. I needed answers. Sable and Dorn, the firm Carmen had worked for, had left behind barely a footprint. But when I dug through archived SEC filings, I found something strange. Before its sudden dissolution, the firm had received a bulk investment from a third-party trust based in Malta. I cross-referenced the trust name with Taylor's firm, Loxton Analytics. It showed up again. Same trust. Different companies. Different states. Different victims. And then it hit me. These weren't just shady employers. They were shell firms, financial skins made to be shed and replaced. Someone had created a network of temporary businesses designed to absorb illicit funds, route them through offshore accounts, and then vanish before anyone asked questions. They used these women, smart, talented women, to process the paperwork. And when the trail got too warm, they were silenced, buried under bureaucracy. The next voice message I recorded was different. It wasn't speculation anymore. I had names. Patterns. I detailed how these companies shared the same P.O. boxes, the same attorneys of record, and how most of them had identical dissolution language filed within 48 hours of each suicide. It wasn't just chilling, it was calculated. I released the episode at midnight. By morning, my inbox was flooded. Some were messages of support. Listeners thanking me for speaking up, for giving them goosebumps, for telling stories that felt too real. Others were different. One email subject line just read, "You're brave," Or stupid. Maybe both. No signature. No IP trace. I started sleeping with the lights on. That week, I received another message. This one from an anonymous burner number. It read, "Not the first. Won't be the last. Look into E. H. Drowned. College student. Same fingerprints." I stared at it for a long time. E. A. It took hours of searching, hours of digging through old police blogs and campus bulletins and online memorials, until I found him. Evan Hart, junior at Newbridge University, drowned in a retention pond behind the Science Center in 2019, ruled an accident after a late-night party. Case closed. No foul play suspected. Except, he had been scheduled to speak the next morning, a student-led financial accountability panel. The topic? Misappropriation of donor funds and the university's ties to third-party investment firms, one of which, you guessed it, had received a payout from that same Malta Trust. I stared at my screen until my vision blurred. They were targeting students now. Evan's case haunted me. He was only 21. Sharp, bold, ready to take on a system designed to chew people like him up. But he didn't make it. His parents had accepted the story they were given. Drunken misadventure. But I found his Reddit posts, his encrypted messages to campus journalists. He had the receipts, drafts of reports, financial leaks. He was ready to talk. Then he was dead. And the most sinister part? His backpack, containing his laptop and research, was found dry, in perfect condition. The police never questioned it. Another true crime story folded into the wallpaper of a university town. Another justice tale the system refused to tell. I aired Evan's story next. And this time, it hit a nerve. Students began reaching out, some anonymously, others trembling with the courage Evan had once carried. One girl sent me screenshots of group chats where financial misconduct had been joked about. Another had photos of internal memos about how to deal with whistleblowers. It was all starting to unravel, but so was I. I hadn't eaten a proper meal in 3 days. I jumped every time I passed a window. I'd wake up in the middle of the night convinced I heard footsteps on my fire escape. But still, I kept going, because I had this feeling in my bones that there were more, that the web went wider. And then I found Isla Marin. She didn't have a gravestone. She wasn't listed as missing in any database. It was as if she had never existed. Except for one thing. A box delivered to my P.O. box. No return address. Inside, a black leather-bound journal, a flash drive, and a letter. My sister is gone. But she tried to stop them. Please, finish what she started. I flipped open the journal. Each page was a map of paranoia. Coded notes, scribbled arrows and names. She had been tracking something massive. Charity fraud, government grants, and overseas holdings disguised as education programs. Isla wasn't just another cog in the wheel. She was the wrench, the anomaly, and someone had made her disappear for it. At the end of her journal was one sentence, circled 3 times in red ink. "The ones who kill for money don't fear bullets. They fear exposure." I knew then that I had a choice. I could walk away, stay safe, return to a quiet life of fluff pieces and forgotten stories. Or I could become something dangerous. Someone who digs. Someone who speaks. Someone who shines a light into the darkest corners of our so-called justice system. I plugged in the flash drive. My computer screen flickered. Dozens of folders appeared, each labeled with names I recognized. Politicians, executives, charities. And one stood out above the rest. Evan Hart, postmortem notes. And inside it, a video file. His last confession. The voices they silenced. I hesitated before clicking the file. There's a strange kind of silence that happens when you're alone in the dark. Staring at a screen you know is about to change your entire perception of reality. The hum of my laptop, the occasional creak of the building, my heartbeat thudding like a war drum. And then I clicked play. The video stuttered at first, grainy footage, the lighting dim, but then his face came into view. Evan Hart, barely lit by a dorm lamp. He looked young, tired, scared, but determined. "If you're seeing this, I'm probably already gone." My throat tightened. They told me to stop digging, told me to stay in my lane. But when I found out about the scholarships, the grants that never reached the students, that the university was laundering money through shell charities and fake research funds, I knew I couldn't stay silent. He shifted, eyes darting off camera. like he wasn't sure he was alone. The weird thing is, it wasn't even the money that scared me. It was how organized it was. Like they had templates, scripts, paper trails designed to vanish. And the second I started asking questions, professors stopped replying. My advisor suddenly retired. And then I started getting followed. He took a shaky breath. This isn't just my school. I think it's everywhere. I found a trust in Malta connected to three other campuses, and one of them is tied to a company called Sable and Dorn. I gasped. He looked directly into the camera. Expose them. Please, don't let them erase me. The screen went black. I don't remember breathing after that. I just sat there, frozen, every nerve in my body screaming. Not out of fear, but clarity. Evan had been murdered. That was no accident. The dry backpack, the missing pages, the scrubbed phone records. It all made sense now. He'd been silenced. Just like Carmen. Just like Taylor. Just like Isla. And if I wasn't careful, I'd be next. But that wasn't the only thing I found on the drive. There were voice memos. Dozens of them. Audio files Isla had recorded during her investigation. Conversations with insiders. Confrontations with supervisors. Whispered calls to anonymous hotlines. You could hear the tension in her voice. This wasn't just research. This was survival. One memo stood out. They call it philanthropy laundering. They use nonprofits to move money offshore. To clean it, children's charities, literacy programs, anything that gets public sympathy. But it's all a lie. The real beneficiaries are shell companies in Cyprus, the Caymans, and Switzerland. Billions. Untraceable. Then came the sound of a door creaking. The audio cut off. I aired an edited version of Evan's confession that week. It was the hardest thing I'd ever done, listening to someone predict their own death, feeling the rage and helplessness swell inside me as the world still tried to look away. But something was different this time. It spread. Fast. The episode trended. Justice Tales was no longer just a niche podcast. It became a movement. DMs flooded in. Emails. Calls. Students. Employees. Parents. Whistleblowers. Some begged me to keep going. Others warned me to stop. But then came a name I hadn't seen in years. Lily Marston. She was a former CFO of a well-known education nonprofit, one that Evan had flagged. She'd disappeared from the public eye years ago after a scandal involving misappropriated funds. But now, she was reaching out to me. The email was short. They destroyed my life. I have the ledgers. Let's talk. I agreed to meet her. Public place. Daylight. Burner phones. I was learning the rules now. Trust no one. Expect surveillance. Record everything. She was older than I remembered. Tired. Like most of us. But there was fire behind her eyes. I was the bookkeeper. I saw where the money went. Every donation routed through five shell companies. Fake board members. Stolen grant money sent to construction firms that didn't exist. She handed me a USB drive. You have a voice. I don't. Not anymore. Use it. That night, I sat in my apartment, USB in hand, and realized something gutting. These weren't just stories anymore. This was evidence. Evidence the world could no longer ignore. But with that realization came the fear. Real fear. That same night, my Wi-Fi glitched. My phone rang once, then stopped. I found a van parked outside my building that hadn't moved in 2 days. I stopped using rideshares, changed my routine, burned through prepaid SIM cards like they were candy. I stopped sleeping, not because I was paranoid, but because I knew someone was watching, listening, waiting for me to slip. But they underestimated me. I wasn't just digging for the truth. I was becoming the truth, and truth doesn't flinch. The next episode I recorded was unlike any before. I named names. I outlined Lily Marston's ledgers, the phantom nonprofits, the hidden financial crimes disguised as charity. I detailed how red tape wasn't a mistake. It was the very tool being used to kill accountability. I used Isla's voice, Evan's face, Carmen's story, Taylor's pain. I turned whispers into roars. And within 48 hours, I was doxxed. My address was leaked. My podcast site hacked. My social media flooded with trolls and thinly veiled death threats. But for every attempt to silence me, 10 more listeners tuned in. 10 more voices joined the chorus. They couldn't stop it now, because for every voice they silenced, dozens more rose up in defiance. Then, I got the call. Blocked number. Voice disguised. I work for one of the organizations you exposed, and I have something you need to see. Meet me. Alone. The line went dead, and for the first time, I hesitated. Because what if this wasn't a story anymore? What if it was a trap? Unveiled, I stared at my phone for a full minute after the call ended. My hands were sweating, my mind racing. Every instinct screamed, "Don't go!" But that voice, digitally altered, clipped with panic and purpose, wasn't threatening. It was pleading. I work for one of the organizations you exposed, and I have something you need to see. Meet me, alone. That word haunted me, alone. In every thriller I'd ever consumed, alone meant death. But this wasn't fiction anymore. This was real. This was now. And if what they had could blow the lid off the entire network of financial corruption, I couldn't ignore it. I left everything behind except a burner phone, a hidden mic, and a small flashlight. I chose a public location with camera coverage, an abandoned train platform still within view of a convenience store's security feed. I memorized every exit, every shadow. At exactly 11:13 a.m., someone stepped out of the dark. Hood up! Hands shaking. Female voice. I don't have much time. What I'm giving you, if they find out. I'm dead. She handed me a small black box, a secure SSD drive, military-grade encryption. This is the real reason they killed Isla. She had copies, drafts of legislation, internal memos, proof that the charities weren't just laundering money, they were influencing votes, buying policy, burrowing into government budgets. I asked her why she was coming forward now, her eyes filled with tears. Because I can't sleep, not after what they did to Evan. And then she vanished into the night. The next morning, I took the drive to a trusted contact, someone who used to work cyber forensics for a federal agency. He owed me a favor. When I showed him the device, he paled. Jade, this isn't just big. This is career-ending for half of D. C. It took 4 hours to break the encryption. What we found inside nearly made me vomit. A trove of files linking public officials to charities that never existed. Millions in education grants funneled into shell firms. Taxpayer money laundered through nonprofits that purchased nothing, built nothing, served no one. Politicians, bankers, lawyers, even two journalists. Everyone had their hands in the same poisoned pot. But the worst part? There were emails, messages between board members talking about cleaning up loose ends. Carmen's name was there. Taylor's, Evan's, and Isla's. They'd all been marked. Systematically, I went quiet for 3 days. No uploads, no tweets. I needed time, not to process. There was no processing this, but to plan. Because I knew once I went public, everything would change. They'd come harder, faster, louder. And still, I hit record. This is Jade Whitlock, and what I'm about to say will either make me a target or make me free. Maybe both. I laid it all out. I read names, organizations, transaction IDs, file dates. I explained how red tape, bureaucracy, and offshore accounts weren't the symptom of corruption. They were the design. A system meant to fail anyone who wasn't wealthy, connected, or willing to stay quiet. And I ended with Isla's voice, one of her last voice notes from the drive. They'll never convict ghosts, but they're real, and they're running everything. The episode was called Unveiled. It exploded. Over 2 million streams in 48 hours. Bookstagram posts flooded in. Celebrities shared it. Hashtags trended. But with the light came the shadows. My landlord called to tell me someone had been trying to access my apartment. My VPN provider was subpoenaed. A former FBI agent called me anonymously and said, "You've stirred a hive. Be careful." But it was too late for careful. The veil had lifted. And the public? They were angry. People began digging, submitting tips, connecting dots in places I hadn't thought to look. And that's when I saw it. A connection between Carmen's fake firm and a humanitarian award given to a senator who once served on the board of Isla's employer. The corruption wasn't just systemic. It was celebrated. I started receiving packages. One was filled with shredded bank statements. Untraceable. Anonymous. One had a burner phone and a single message. "They've been watching you since Carmen." And one had a bullet. No note. Just the sound of someone laughing when I picked up the phone that rang seconds later. But for every threat, 10 more people came forward. A teacher who lost her pension when her school's investments mysteriously evaporated. A widow whose late husband had been accidentally overdosed after filing a complaint about grant fraud in his company. A lawyer who had once represented one of the charities, now suicidal with guilt. It wasn't just a crime ring. It was a network. Global. Untouchable. Until now. And still, there was more. The whistleblower I met, the one who gave me the SSD, reached out again. "There's something I didn't give you." We met again, this time in a motel off Route 1. Far from cell towers and city lights, she looked different, paranoid, thinner, afraid of every sound. She handed me a single sheet of paper, redacted, but one name was still visible, Lily Marston, and next to it, known asset. She wasn't just an insider, she was planted, a cleaner, until she flipped. I didn't want to believe it, but it made sense. Her fall from grace, her disappearance, the ledgers she had. Maybe she was trying to atone, or maybe she was setting me up. Either way, I had just become a player in a game with no rules. I returned home that night with one thought echoing in my head. Who can I trust? The deeper I got, the fewer answers I had. And yet, I knew what I had to do. Finish it, no matter what it cost. Because if we don't tell these stories, no one will. And silence is the soil where corruption grows. The next morning, my podcast app crashed. My episodes? Deleted. Every file. Every backup. Gone. And in my inbox, one final message. Welcome to the real shadows of justice. So, into the shadows of justice. The first thing I noticed was silence. Not the kind that feels peaceful, but the kind that feels like something's missing, like something's been erased. My phone didn't vibrate. My podcast app wouldn't load. My emails were bouncing. And when I tried to log into the podcast dashboard, account not found. Now everything was gone. Every episode, every upload, every subscriber, years of audio, wiped in seconds. It was like I had never existed. And that's when I realized they weren't just coming for me. They were erasing me. I drove 6 hours north that day. No GPS, no calls, just back roads and a gut full of panic. I had a backup drive, thank God. But even that felt flimsy against the machine I was now up against. This wasn't just bureaucracy anymore. This was warfare. Digital. Psychological. Designed to break me down until I quietly slipped into irrelevance. But what they didn't count on, I'd been preparing for this. I booted up the old burner laptop, the one I'd used when I first started Justice Tales. I launched a hidden RSS feed, encrypted it with a failsafe I'd never thought I'd need, and uploaded one last entry. If you're hearing this, they tried to erase me, but you can't delete the truth. That episode spread like wildfire. I called it Into the Shadows, a 10-minute manifesto about control, corruption, and the consequences of speaking too loudly in a system built to punish whistleblowers. I talked about Carmen, Taylor, Evan, Isla, and now, me. The hashtags reignited, were shadows of justice. Unveiled, we're Jade. Listeners uploaded mirror versions of my episodes on their own channels. Reddit threads popped up dissecting the files Lily gave me. TikTok sleuths uncovered new names. Activists demanded investigations. The movement had become bigger than me. But still, I wasn't safe. 2 nights later, my apartment was broken into. Nothing was taken, but everything was moved. Drawers left open. Papers scattered. A USB stick placed neatly in the center of my desk with a note. "You're still not listening." I scanned it in a lab. Inside was a single file. A spreadsheet with 6 names, each one crossed out, except the last. Whitlock, Jade, status pending. I vomited in the sink. I called Lily, no answer. I called the whistleblower, disconnected. The walls were closing in, and in that dark, suffocating moment, I thought about ending it, shutting everything down, disappearing, changing my name, leaving behind the files, the voice, the cause. But then I remembered Carmen's voicemail transcript. "They're here. They know I know. They'll kill me." And I remembered Evan's video. "Expose them. Please." I couldn't walk away. Not now. So I did the only thing left. I went live. No edits. No script. Just me. On a live stream, holding every piece of evidence in my hands. I read from Isla's journal. I played Evan's voice again. I showed Lily's ledgers line by line, explaining how financial scams were being woven into federal spending bills, charity budgets, and youth programs. I laid bare the truth. This wasn't just theft. This was treason. And the world listened. Mainstream media picked it up, slowly at first, hesitantly. But once public pressure surged, they couldn't look away. Government agencies issued statements. Vague, hollow. One senator resigned. Another released a press statement calling me a fraud with an agenda. But my inbox kept filling. More stories. More victims. More truth. And the real breaking point came when a former IRS analyst leaked documents proving that over $140 million had been funneled through nonprofits exposed in my series, then disappeared through offshore accounts linked to corporate PACs and shell companies. It was irrefutable. And suddenly, silence wasn't an option anymore. But victory is never clean. 2 days after that livestream, Lily Marston was found dead in a hotel room. No ID. No trace. The authorities called it a mental health crisis. I called it what it was, a hit. They'd silenced her one final time. And yet, even as the darkness pressed in, I could feel the tremors, something shifting, the kind of unrest that precedes change. A congressional hearing was announced. A task force was formed. One of the shell charities had its assets frozen. It wasn't justice, not yet. But it was something, a sliver of light inside the shadows. Still, I didn't feel safe. I left Boston, rented a cabin 3 states away, burned everything non-essential, disconnected. And then I got the call. Blocked number, same altered voice. One more case, one more file. This one connects everything. I froze. The voice continued. But to tell it, you'll need to come see me. In person. No phones, no recordings, just you and the truth. See, I closed my eyes, took a deep breath, and whispered, where? The ones who dig, they told me to come alone. No phones, no recordings, no aliases, just me and the truth. I didn't ask for a location. It arrived in a plain envelope taped to the inside of my cabin door the next morning. There were no tire tracks in the snow, no footprints, just the envelope and a note inside. It ends where it began. I knew what it meant. Carmen Delgado's building, the high-rise in Boston, where she was found dead. The one no one investigated. The one the city had all but forgotten. I didn't tell anyone. Not my contact. Not my listeners. If I was being led into a trap, I had already decided it was worth it. Because this was never about staying safe. It was about telling the truth. The elevator still worked. That eerie, stuttering kind of mechanical hum that makes your skin crawl. Floor 9, Unit 903. I stood at the door for a long time before I knocked. It opened halfway. Inside was a man, late 50s, worn down by time and secrets. His face was familiar. I'd seen it on old donor lists, once tied to the board of a now-defunct education nonprofit. He didn't say his name. He just gestured toward the table where a manila file sat waiting. That's everything. Isla's files. The original drafts. Real names. Real votes. Financial crimes the public has no idea about. They didn't just launder money. They rewrote legislation, bought off departments, covered murders with bureaucratic silence. I opened the file, and for a moment, the room tilted. Inside were classified communications, emails between lawmakers, corporate leaders, and charity board members. They discussed quiet removals, redactions of autopsy reports, and calculated financial schemes using disaster relief funds to move cash offshore. Every name I had ever whispered into a microphone was there. And more, much more. Why me? I asked. Why now? He took a long breath. Because it's all crumbling, and someone needs to tell it before they rewrite the ending, before they pin it on the dead. I left that apartment with the file sealed against my chest, like a defibrillator for the dying truth. I drove for hours, tears blurring the road, not from fear, but from knowing what it meant to finally hold proof and the weight that comes with it. The final episode took days to craft. I locked myself in a borrowed basement studio. I backed up the files to 3 encrypted servers. I recorded without a script, just my voice, shaking but steady, as I walked the world through every uncovered scheme, every sinister case, every victim buried under a mountain of red tape. I called the episode The Ones Who Dig. Because that's what we are, the ones who claw through lies, who bleed for stories no one else dares to tell, who are willing to be buried ourselves just to leave behind a trail for someone else to follow. It was more than an upload. It was an unveiling. In the hours that followed, chaos erupted. Hashtags trended globally. Seize your justice tales. Red tape kills. Shadows of justice. The ones who dig protesters gathered outside federal buildings. Demands for resignations flooded the Capitol. A class action lawsuit was filed on behalf of families who lost loved ones under the false guise of suicide. And then the unthinkable happened. The DOJ opened an investigation. For the first time, officially, someone in power said, "We're listening." I didn't celebrate. I didn't sleep. I watched, waited, prepared for the inevitable backlash, because I know this story will never end with confetti. It ends with scars, and those scars become maps for the next voice who dares to speak. A month later, I stood at Carmen Delgado's grave. There was no stone, no plaque, so I brought one. I placed it gently into the soil. The inscription burned into it with quiet defiance. She knew. She spoke. They buried her. But we are the ones who dig. I don't know how long I have, how long before they come for me, like they did the others. But I've made peace with that, because I didn't choose this path. The truth chose me. And now, it belongs to you. This is Jade Whitlock. And if I vanish, keep digging. Oh.